Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2020. I'm now here with E. Michael Jones. Now, E. Michael Jones probably needs no introduction to most people. This is the first time that he's appeared on Millennial, and indeed it's the first time that he and I have ever spoken. So we should have spoken before this for various reasons, but it didn't happen. So E. Michael Jones, welcome to Millennial, and thank you for taking part.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I suppose an interesting thing just to start off with would be, what are your impressions of 2020 so far? This has obviously been an incredible year for various reasons. What are your salient observations as we prepare to depart this year?
Well, we have been punished. The England, France, the United States, Germany, to some extent, the entire world is being punished for the uprising against the oligarchs, which took place 4 years ago. So I'm talking about the election of Donald Trump and Brexit in England, the yellow vest protest in France, various other things. Nothing happened in Germany 4 years ago, but it started. It was starting to happen. There was a kind of nationalist reaction. We're talking about the rise of nationalism, the return of the repressed. We've had groups of people who are so disgusted with the globalist hypocrisy, the globalist system of just more and more draconian oligarchic control, that people actually started talking about it. And 2019 was the year that they broke through on the internet and started to be punished there. The deplatforming that took place in 2019. But this was just a dress rehearsal for 2020 when they rolled out COVID as the way to punish the entire world and teach them a lesson. So COVID is real. It's not as bad as people are playing it up to be. I got it. It lasted. It was like a mild cold. I had a slight fever for 2 days. I had a sore throat for 2 days, and then it was pretty much over. That's it. So, given that that severity of the disease, which has been played up enormously, we are now confronted with the opposite, which is namely the rollout of the vaccine and the playing down of the dangers of the vaccine. So, after telling us that we're all going to die, and that turned out not to be true. Now they're telling us that hope has just arrived in the form of the vaccine. And so we're all supposed to rush out and take the vaccine. But then wait a minute. The early reports are coming in that a lot of people are getting sick from the vaccine. So the situation, the COVID virus was instrumentalized in the United States to defeat Donald Trump. Everybody knows that now. One of the main vehicles for cheating on the election was mail-in ballots. Mail-in ballots.
You're jumping ahead. I was going to ask you what. I don't disagree, but let me just intervene with a question. You said global oligarchic control. What is oligarchy? And I know that people could just Google the definition, but what do you mean when you say global oligarchic control?
Oligarchy means rule of the few. The few throughout history have always been associated with certain things. For example, creditor versus debtor. There are always more debtors than there are creditors. So the creditors, the people who get rich and fat from usury, they are part of this oligarchic establishment. In the United States, it became the people who basically were profiting from directly from running the American empire, the people who profited the most. The deep state was used. It's always been throughout history. I mean, that's why we have a Greek word for it. There's always been a group of people who have been known as the ruling class. In the United States of America, there was supposed to be some type of different arrangement. We had representative government, but it became clear about 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, that these people, the people who controlled the information, who controlled the money, who controlled the military, whatever, you know, all they put, who control education, who control the university, who control publishing. You put all these things together, and these people were unhappy. They were unhappy at what they were seeing because there was pushback from the normal people. So in Indiana, the first manifestation of this was the homosexual juggernaut, the normalization of homosexuality, the imposition of homosexuality on the normal people of the United States of America, created a pushback in state legislatures. And it became clear that there was a conflict here between oligarchy and representative government, the state legislature of Indiana being an example. They passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which said you didn't have to bake a cake for a gay wedding if you owned a bakery. The oligarchs, specifically Mark Benioff, head of Salesforce, flew into Indianapolis and told the legislators they had to overturn their law. Now, this is arrogance at best and treason at worst. You're trying to overthrow the government. This was just the beginning. Just the beginning. Because 1 year after that, I was at the rally for Donald Trump, and the people of Indiana, the majority, the overwhelming majority of people in Indiana, woke up to the fact that no one represented their interests in the political system, and they were all going to vote for Donald Trump, and that got him elected. The same thing happened this year. Nobody's saying that Indiana was a contested state. We all know that it went overwhelmingly for Trump. The fact that it happened in other states that did not happen is a contested issue that needs to be addressed. Now, that's what I'm talking about.
So I can imagine somebody listening to this stream and hearing you say, the people who control education, the people who control this and that. And I can imagine someone saying, that sounds very conspiratorial. What would you say to that?
Yes, they are conspirators. There's no question about it. They have rooms, they meet in rooms, and they decide to do things. And so there was the Transition Integrity Project. There's a conspiracy for you. I can name one conspiracy after another. Yes, it's only a conspiracy when poor people do it. Otherwise, it's called strategic planning. So, of course, these people have the wherewithal to make those type of plans, and they have the wherewithal to make them happen. Mr. Zuckerberg gave $500 million. This is a report, you know, we can check it out. $500 million to sway the election. I've already done articles about Ireland. Ireland was conquered by state-of-the-art warfare, which is basically big tech, Google, the control of information. They manipulated the information so effectively that they got the people of Ireland basically to abandon their religion, abandon Catholicism, and vote for both abortion and gay marriage. This is horrendous.
It is an astonishing transformation that's occurred in Ireland. And I've noted this myself before, that basically it seems that all of the techniques that had been mastered for subverting countries and transforming them before that, all of these techniques that had been developed over the last 100 years or so, were suddenly applied in a very refined form, applied to Ireland, with the result that it rapidly lost its ancestral culture, its ancestral identity, and became, well, the seat of Google and Silicon Valley, away from Silicon Valley.
Yeah, that's right. I talked to John Waters about this. He was involved. He was a journalist, a kind of a rock journalist at the beginning, and then a standard journalist. And he talked about the fact that he was basically driven out of his job by Twitter. You could launch lynch mobs on Twitter. He mentioned, just to give you some indication of how this works, before, when you wrote a letter to the editor to the newspaper, you had to identify yourself. And you had to give your name and address and maybe a phone number, and they might even call you to see if it's really you. This has all been abolished with the internet. So we don't know whether anybody, you could have 500 likes on Facebook, and it may be one Jew in Israel pushing a button 500 times because he likes what you say. We don't know. We just don't know. And what you have is the manipulation of these mobs, this mob type of psychology being exercised politically. And the push, the outcome here has been a complete and total control of the flow of information. That's the state-of-the-art warfare in the world today. This is a group of people who are waging war against any identity they don't like. Any identity they don't like. And usually these are national identities. So you have Ireland as the prime example. Poland and Hungary are now in the sights of the EU because they object to the homosexual juggernaut and immigration and various other things. So either you go along or you're going to be crushed. And so you have countries like France basically using the COVID epidemic as an excuse to ban people from the streets. And that conveniently ended the yellow vest protest for Macron.
Indeed, it did. When you say, and I laughed at the phrase because it sounds amusing, but when you said the homosexual juggernaut, what do you mean exactly by that phrase?
Juggernaut is it comes from India, and it was a basically an idol on a cart, and the cart had just absolutely huge wheels. You can Google pictures of it, okay? And the people there would work themselves up to a type of religious frenzy where they throw themselves under the wheels of the juggernaut in a kind of act of holy suicide. Well, that's pretty much what it's like. And we actually have the people throwing themselves under the wheels of the homosexual juggernaut. The Irish did it. That's by voting in gay marriage, which is a preposterous impossibility. This is the power of the control of information. You can actually access people's minds and convince them to do something that's completely against their self-interest. That's what they did in Ireland. The same thing was going on in Australia. Again, Australia used to be a penal colony. That's why those people are there. And now it's a neo-penal colony, because when your great-grandfather got put on a prison ship, he knew he was a prisoner. When these people vote for gay marriage, they are basically locking themselves in their own prison cell every night and telling themselves they're free because they did something stupid like that. That's why I'm talking. That's why it's a juggernaut. It's just gets this. It's a religious idol that gets up this momentum, and a lot of people throw themselves in front of it. And if you get too close to it, you get hurt.
And what is the point of things like gay marriage? Why is that being encouraged in Western countries?
To break down marriage. So to answer that question, we have to take a step back and you say, why is sexual liberation being promoted in these countries? Because this is only the latest version of sexual liberation. And I happened to write a book on that. And I said, basically, because sexual liberation is a form of political control. That's what it is. That's why the oligarchs promote it. That's why during the lockdown, you can get a free subscription to Pornhub, but you can't go to church. It's obvious. The big year for this was last year when suddenly that idea took flight on the internet, and I had a lot of young guys who had pornography addictions. And suddenly I said, sexual liberation is a form of control, and that's why you have pornography, to keep you under control. I didn't have to say anything more than that, and they suddenly understood. I didn't have to tell these guys, you're a slave of your passions. They knew that already. All I had to do was give them an explanation of why they were there, how this thing worked politically, and suddenly it became clear to them what was going on, and a lot of them just cured their habit simply by understanding the idea. That all happened last year.
Well, yeah, and just to interject, I mean, absolutely, something might feel good. That doesn't mean that it's good for you, and it's surprising that many people don't know that. I think that was something that was probably a given in times past. Something might feel good in the moment, that doesn't mean it's good for you long term. But just on the matter of Pornhub and COVID, because this year, I'm pretty sure that Pornhub actually announced that because there was going to be this very big lockdown in Italy because of COVID, they announced that subscriptions to Pornhub would be free for those months. It was something like that. I can't remember the exact details now, but basically Pornhub opened itself up to Italians who were going to be in lockdown. And I thought, You know, that's amazing, because this would have been a time when presumably there could have been a big baby boom in Italy with all these young Italians, you know, cooped up together. But instead, they'll be watching Pornhub for free.
That's right. That's proof that it's a form of control. I used to give talks about the Israelis invading Ramallah and putting pornography on Palestinian TV stations. I said, why do you think they did this? To bring freedom to the Palestinians? No, it's because pornography is a weapon. It's one of the major weapons in the arsenal of cultural warfare right now. It seems it's gone in abeyance. Last year, it was a big topic. November was NoFap November. And that when the people swore off porn and masturbation, that made the news at Rolling Stone. And they were all accused of being anti-Semites for not watching pornography. That was a big thing last year. It's been superseded by the COVID crisis, which has pushed everything else out of the way, along with all of the rioting that took place, all of which was orchestrated to depose Donald Trump.
Yeah, and I think it would be worth explaining why porn, because you say that porn is a means of control. What was the conception of a man, like let's say 200 years ago, that we are now moving away from, or have moved away from? That, you know, that what is it that porn is used to do to distort people? What is it that how does it change us?
It isolates you, first of all. Lust darkens the mind. That's what St. Thomas Aquinas said, so that you can't think properly. Your passions are ruling your life, which means you can be easily manipulated because you've lost logos, you've lost reason, and that's the one sure guide that you need in life to have a successful life. Specifically, the group that gets targeted is the young people. So beginning, let's say 20-year-olds, okay? Now, traditionally, if you want to talk about what's the main issue facing a 20-year-old? Well, it's marriage, because that's the normal path of mankind. And this, in our culture, pretty much, that's when it happens. Well, this blocks that. And why would they be interested in blocking marriage? Well, because the oligarchs that I've talked about before, have always been interested in population control. They've always feared demographic power. The main manifestation of demographic power in the United States after World War II was the Catholic Church, because that church had banned the use of contraception, still bans it, still considers it sinful. And so rich people like the Rockefellers created things like the Population Council to basically attack other ethnic groups. That's what it's about. I for a long time, I thought, wait a minute, why are Americans attacking Americans? Well, let me let in on something. There is no such thing as an American, certainly not anymore. Okay, back then, there were three ethnic groups, Protestants, Catholics, and Jews. It was called the Triple Melting Pot. And basically, America was Yugoslavia, and you had three ethnic ethnic groups engaged in covert warfare with each other, or two groups ganging up on the one, the Protestants and the Jews ganging up on the Catholics. The church still hasn't figured this out. The church is still living in an era where they think that warfare is people in blue uniforms firing cannons at people in red uniforms or something like that. But that is the state-of-the-art warfare, and that's what's been going on here. So you intervene in this crucial moment in a group that you don't like. Well, that group is expanding. You can define it as white people. That's a category of the mind that gets imposed on Greek people to enslave them. And then you create bad habits among these people. They don't get married. They become docile, isolated consumers of whatever you have to sell. That's the whole point of life here in the United States of America, according to the oligarchs. Can't hear you.
Sorry, I was muted. You said that, and I wasn't sure whether we would get onto this topic or not, but you said that the category of white is what is a category of the mind that's imposed on people in order to control them.
Right.
Could you explain that?
Yeah, I'll give you a good example. The whole battle, uh, this over the statue in St. Louis this summer. There were statues coming down left and right all across America, in England as well. The guy, the slave trader, went into the bay in Colchester, among other places.
Bristol, yeah, it was Edward Colston.
Yeah, so here we go. St. Louis, statue's got to connect. Well, which statue? You remember Charlottesville? That was the white boys coming to defend Robert E. Lee. Okay, and they were slaughtered. Okay, they were just obliterated. They're still in legal jeopardy because of that chubby lesbian Roberta Kaplan, who has decided to ruin their lives. Okay, so now it's St. Louis. Well, it turns out it's not Robert E. Lee. It's St. Louis. Well, what did he do? Did he have slaves? Was he a slave trader? No, he lived in the 13th century in France. And, well, what did he do wrong? Why is this grudge? Because it was portrayed as a black-white battle. Why are the black folk here in St. Louis upset about St. Louis? Well, it turns out they're not, really, because the St. Louis's big crime was that he burned the Talmud. Well, wait a minute. Why are blacks upset about burning the Talmud? They're not. But the point here of this is, this man, Umar Lee, who was running this operation, had to portray it as a black-white conflict. Because as soon as you're white, you lose. Because everybody knows if you're white, you're a racist. That's what he had to do. And that's, at this point, I intervened in that by writing an article. And I said, wait a minute, this is not a black-white battle. It's a Catholic-Jewish battle. You look at those, so who are those people at the statue? It turns out they're praying the rosary. Do white supremacists pray the rosary? No, they're Catholics. And as soon as I straightened this thing out and said it was a Catholic Jewish battle, guess what? They lost. Umar Lee challenged me to a debate immediately. He didn't know who I was before that. And then we went around and around, and he couldn't refute what I was saying. There's a video of these. You know, he's calling people, it's white supremacists at the statue. Black Lives Matter shows up and they beat up this white 60-year-old white guy who's holding the rosary. So it was identity theft. I'm saying the whole white thing here is identity theft. It's across the board identity theft, but it was obviously identity theft in St. Louis. And that's why it's such an important issue. And that's why I wrote the article about it. And because of that, that statue is still standing. They didn't take that statue down. They lost because they couldn't engage in identity theft.
I can understand that in the context of the specific thing you're talking about there, that white is used to attack people. But obviously you group them together and then you attack them. But surely the fact that it's possible to group them together in the first place, you know, it means that they already have some kind of innate thing that is, you know, European genetics.
You're white what is a white guy? A white guy is a Protestant who doesn't go to church anymore. That's what a white guy is. A white guy is a victim of identity theft. I had this discussion with Frody on Alish's show. Alish is a Slovenian. I wish we had this debate in Zagreb. Okay, I really wish we had. Because I was waiting to ask Jared Taylor, are Serbs white or are Croats white? And if they're both white, why have they been fighting each other for over a millennium? Okay? So anyway, I said to Frody.
Well, there are denominations within the church, too, but they're all Christians. I mean, you know, there are denominations. Yeah, you know, it's two subcategories within a category.
Well, the battle, the distinction between Serb and Croat is religious. You're right. It's a religious distinction that has no basis in race. Race does not apply. Race is an American issue. I can even tell you when the first time white was used to describe a human being. Okay? It was 1613. You can look it up in the Oxford English Dictionary according to historical principles. It was in a play. And why did it happen in 1613? Because that's the time of the arrival, the beginning of the Virginia colony in America, where they had a proletariat there to grow tobacco that was part black and part white. And they needed to distinguish these things to divide the proletariat there. That's where it happened. So I asked Frody, Frody, were you baptized? Yes, he was. He was a Lutheran. Okay, well, you were a Lutheran and you speak Norwegian. Isn't that enough to give you an identity? When did you become white? You've never been white. Englishmen weren't white until they showed up in Virginia. And the only reason they became white is because they were confronted with a large group of people who were black. So you're never white until you come in contact with people who are black.
Of course, and it's a distinction then, it's a contrast. But would you accept that white is a thing, it's just not an identity for you? I mean, would you accept it as a genetic fact?
What do you mean by a thing? Of course,
a genetic fact.
If you want to say, you know, I've got a certain color skin, a certain shaped nose, and so on and so forth, of course I do. And if you say, I was planning to show this picture of nun from Kenya holding my grandson. Can you figure out which one of these people is my grandson? Or my grandchild? Of course you can. Of course we have these features. Of course they are. The problem comes when you try and use them as the basis for your identity. Because
now, that's interesting, because I'm glad you've said that, because I think that perhaps clarifies for a lot of people the... Because you probably know that you've got a bit of a reputation here for a blind spot. That's what people think. Do you know that?
I have no idea what my reputation is.
Okay. Well, all right. People seem to think that you just don't understand that whiteness is a thing, European genetics exist. But I think you do. It's just that you don't think they constitute an identity.
It doesn't determine your behavior. Language determines your behavior.
I don't know. Jared Taylor might have something to say about that. I mean, there are genes which do seem to, and hormone levels and so on, which do seem to influence or govern behavior to some extent.
Hormones govern behavior. Okay. Hormones. Okay.
Testosterone, estrogen, estradiol, that kind of thing.
Okay. And there are all sorts of biological factors that go into your makeup. I'm not denying that. I'm not saying that we are angels here that have no body. I'm just saying that when it comes to the organization of all of this material, the organizing principle is logos, which is the word for language and for reason. It's also the organizing principle of ethnicity throughout the world. So if you go to Tanzania or Kenya, Tanzania, 76 different ethnic groups. Well, they all look the same to me. They're all black. You know, I can't tell any difference, but they're all different because the language is what makes them different. And I think that is the distinguishing characteristic and not white. Okay. And I'm saying further, look, you know, there was a story about the biker rally. You know, in Sturgis, and somebody yelled, "Hey, asshole," and everybody turned around. Now, do you turn around when people yell, "Hey, asshole"? I try not to. But the point I'm trying to make here is you can impose this category on yourself, and the oligarchs will rejoice if you do this, because the minute you impose this category on you, you lose. That's the lesson of Charlottesville. When I broke this identity theft in St. Louis, the statue was still standing and those Catholics won because they were able to assert their real identity.
Yeah, but you could also say that as soon as you impose this category of white upon yourself, you win, because, you know, it's all to do with how you play it, surely. I mean, as soon as I call myself white, I've lost. It doesn't have to be that way, does it?
I suppose not. There was a time when if you use the word white, you won. But it's always been some type of artificial construct that got imposed on for political reasons. I'm saying it's never been a source of real identity. Now, I did give a talk at the death of Sam Francis, in which I tried to make this distinction from an American point of view, and trying to say, look, I am ethnic group. I come from a big city in the north. I was raised as a Catholic. That's a distinct group of people. You, Sam, began as a person from the south. And the idea of white and black were very important issues in the South, especially during his lifetime, because that was the rise of the civil rights movement, where this whole dynamic was weaponized by the United States of America as a way of destroying the South. So it was the same thing back then. So I'm not saying that didn't exist. I'm just, at that point, all I said was, we are two different ethnic groups. That's all. I think we can align, but to say that we're both white, that's not true. The biggest tragedy that happened to the Catholic ethnics in northern cities like Chicago was that they allowed this identity theft and the word white got imposed on them and they couldn't defend themselves. This happened in Marquette Park in 1966. Okay, Martin Luther King shows up at Marquette Park. As soon as Martin Luther King and his boys are on one side of the street, the people on the other side of the street become automatically white. Well, that's not what they were. They were Lithuanians. Okay, that was their identity. They were Lithuanians confronted with a threat of ethnic cleansing through and the main vehicle for this ethnic cleansing was the black-white dynamic. They were white. They were before in cities like Chicago, you had a right to live in a Lithuanian neighborhood and people would leave you alone. Okay, that was abrogated by the federal government when they changed the categories from ethnicity to race. And at that point, from country of origin to race, and from that point, they have been losing. They've been losing ever since. All the way. It's the same issue right now. What do you think Black Lives Matter is? Okay, it's this grievance that supposedly goes back and back and back. No, it's not that. It's the resurrection of the Black Jewish Alliance. It is the orchestration of race for political purposes. That's all it's ever been. I'm going back to Virginia as well, 1613. That's all it was then. It's just that the polls were reversed. It was orchestrated to divide the proletariat back then so that they couldn't unite and get decent wages.
So what would you say about, let's say, a guy who's black from Kenya and he moves to Dublin? And he speaks with an Irish accent. His children speak with an Irish accent, and all that. Is he Irish?
Irish. If you mean by Irish an Irish citizen, that's an official statement. Okay. If you're talking about, I've been through this thing with a couple of times. It was Poland the last time around.
I'm using Ireland because I suspect that's closer to your heart than Poland.
It is, but it closer is still is Germany because I'm half German. My mother's German. And I was in Germany. And I understood, so we looked exactly the same, pretty much, although they thought I looked English. But there wasn't that type of distinction. But the most important thing was that you had to learn the language. That's because that's the most important thing when it comes to your identity. That's in a sense who you are.
So when this Kenyan guy learns English and he's speaking with an Irish accent in Dublin, what then? What does he become? Is he still a Kenyan guy in Ireland, or does he become an Irishman?
Well, if you're going to talk specifically about the real situation rather than a theoretical situation, the theory called the triple melting pot, which is what I'm talking about in America, says that after three generations, religion becomes the source of your ethnic identity in America. So if you're talking about, the Irish, it already happened. The Spanish Armada crashed on the shores of Ireland, and those Spaniards crawled into Ireland, and they all intermarried, married Irish women, and that's the source of the Black Irish, if you want to talk about their genetic makeup. But they became Irishmen. Of course they did. Of course they did. So if you understand the time frame and all the other particularities, of course they can. Of course they can. I was in a position where they wanted me to become a German. Why didn't I become a German? Something I think it was the biggest mistake of my life. I could have had a pension by now. I could be living in Mallorca on a pension. But I felt that I was an American for some reason or other. But I couldn't become a German. It was pretty clear because, and the main criterion was the fact that I spoke German. I spoke German fluently. That's the main criterion.
I can't quite see you as a German either. You seem far too very rebellious in your spirit, and I don't see that as a very German thing.
Yes, that's that. We could talk about Germany as the ongoing tragedy of Germany. We could talk about that too, because that's also a form of social engineering. If you go along with social engineering, you will end up like Germany. And I've described that in depth in a book. Logos Rising is my most recent book, and there's a chapter called Werner Heisenberg and Jewish Science, where I talk about the sexual corruption and social engineering of the German people that took place after World War II. Vicious form of social engineering that basically destroyed the ethnic solidarity of the German people.
Oh yes, a lot has been done to the German people. That's quite cruel. Somebody asks, so if you move to China and learn Chinese, do you become a Chinaman? And I should say, I don't endorse the use of racial slurs or anything, just for the sake of, you know, in case that needs to be said. But do you...
Example, what you just said, Sidney Rittenberg, a Jew, okay? He's volunteers in the army. His parents has a gift for language. He learns Chinese. Okay, so he's over there with the American occupying army. His time is up, and the Chinese make him an offer. They say, become a Chinaman. So the Jew became a Chinaman. Okay, and not only did he become a Chinaman, okay, he became the leader, one of the major leaders of the Cultural Revolution of 1966. There's Google image. There's the Jew, Sidney Rittenberg, standing there with his Mao Zedong hat on, holding the little red book of Chairman Mao, addressing 100,000 Chinamen in perfect Chinese.
My fellow Chinaman kind of thing.
This is an actual case. This is not theoretical anymore. He married two Chinese women. One dumped him, and then he married another one. He was a Chinaman. He was a Jewish Chinaman.
Wow, this gets us into very. I'm not accustomed to being on this sort of territory, not for a long time anyway.
I said neither am I.
But YouTube has become very restrictive for a long time. So but this is on DLive. So, it does seem stereotypical that this Jewish guy would become Chinese and then immediately take part in a cultural revolution.
Aside from his language ability and the fact that he learned Chinese, which is not easy to do, what was the common denominator there? How that he got on so well? It was the Jewish revolutionary spirit. That's what it was. He embodied the Jewish revolutionary spirit.
But hadn't he become Chinese, though?
What's that?
Hadn't he become Chinese?
Just because you live in a certain country doesn't mean you shed the Jewish revolutionary spirit. If there's
so something... is it genetic?
Is it genetic? It's religious. It's logos. It's the rejection of logos that get passed on from one Jewish generation to another, whether it's in the synagogue or the Communist Party headquarters or wherever it is. That's what gives the Jew his identity. It's his rejection of logos, and that's been passed on for 2,000 years. Now, you can claim, maybe the Jew claims that sometimes he claims it's genetic. So, you can say, well, my mother was Jewish, so therefore I'm a Jew. But even the Jews don't believe that. Okay, they don't believe it. And I can prove it to you because for the case of Oswald Rufeisen, it was a Jew who was in Poland, worked for the SS, except that he was a double agent who was really working for the Jews. He would inform them when a pogrom was imminent. And after they found out who he was, he went to hiding in a Carmelite monastery, and he became a Catholic. And then he became a priest. And then the war ended, and then Israel started, and he thought, well, I'm going to Israel. I'm going to get citizenship. And he went there, and they turned him down. Wait a minute. What's you said it was, if you had a Jewish mother, you could come and they'd give you citizenship. Well, no, wait a minute. if you have a Jewish mother and you don't get baptized. Well, wait a minute. That's water that drips across your forehead. How did that change my DNA? Well, it didn't change the DNA. What they're saying is that the essence of being a Jew is rejection of Logos, specifically the Logos, Jesus Christ, and his Catholic Church. That proves that's the source of Jewish identity.
Although you do get atheistic Jews.
What's that got nothing to do with
it? I'm saying they're not religious, are they?
You can reject Logos in any number of ways. The fact that you're an atheist means that you reject the existence of God, which is the ultimate manifestation of Logos. So, of course, an atheist is at war against Logos, and that would fit naturally with the Jewish personality. That's why so many prominent Jews are atheists. You know, Sigmund Freud, good example.
Oh, loads of them. Yeah, of course. So, obviously they are a complicated people, and they are rife with contradictions and different factions and all that. But I know that, for example, that in at least one case, citizenship for Israel was judged, or what was it? The right to get citizenship of Israel was judged by genetics. I mean, that there was a judge who ruled in Israel that you could do that.
Well, why didn't they do it to Oswald Wolfeisen then? That went all the way to the Supreme Court.
Well, if it was right after the war, they probably couldn't do DNA tests then.
So, what did DNA tests prove? Nothing. Nothing. These are not Semites anyway. The Ashkenazi are not Semites. And so that's one myth that is going to have to go. Shlomo Sand exposed this myth. These people are Turkic. The Ashkenazis are a Turkic race. So they don't have DNA that goes back to Moses. Because being a child of Moses has nothing to do with your DNA. This is a tenet of the Christian religion and the Catholic faith. Okay? The Jews said to Jesus Christ, we're the sperm of Abraham. We're special. And you better pay attention to what we say. And he says, wait, you know, God doesn't need your DNA. In order to be a child of Moses, you have to accept me. And that is the refutation of their whole genetic mumbo jumbo.
All right. So, I mean, do you have much time for genetics at all?
There's nothing wrong with genetics if you keep it in its proper place. I know I have a guy friend who's got a software company that basically does genetics and predicts how you're going to die, because he claims that you're going to die the way your parents died. And most deaths and diseases are genetic in their orientation, and so therefore it's good to know so that you can deal with them. So I got nothing against genetics. I got something against the use of it to explain what it can't explain.
So what would you say to someone who said, I was born in a stable, but I'm not a horse, kind of thing?
Let me think about that. I'm not sure what the implication. You're going to have to unpack that one for me.
It means that your genetics do have an effect on who you end up being and what you end up being.
Of course it does. You know, your face and your hair are completely unique, and they're the product of genetics, as mine is. But so what? So what? It's what you. That doesn't control my life. If it did, if my life were controlled by the shape of my nose, I'd be in big trouble. Okay. You know.
Well, yeah.
But the point here is that's why we have Logos. All these things are given, and it's Logos that makes you make decisions according to Logos to make out of them something that they cannot become by themselves. That's the whole point of writing a book like Logos is Rising, to give people a sense of hope now, because you don't have to be tyrannized by scientists, because you have Logos too. And when you're confronted with two contradictory scientific explanations, you have the ability to make judgments about them. You have the ability to take control of your life. You have an ability to connect with God. All of these things revolve around Logos. You have an ability to talk to some guy all the way in England who believes the complete opposite of what you believe and still have some type of meeting in the minds. This is all Logos, not genetics.
All right. Well, we can go into Logos later on if you'd like. I think it would be nice to get that discussed and nailed down. But what I would like to ask you is, back just on the genetics thing before we move on from that, what do you think about eugenics? I mean, what do you think about, for example, saying to the government, saying to people, we're going to pay highly intelligent couples money to have more kids so that we end up with a population that is more intelligent?
Totally stupid idea. Totally. It reminds me of Bertrand.
How?
Bertrand Russell, some a homely guy, you know, a homely looking guy. Okay. But he had the reputation of being smart. So some woman came up to him and said, why don't we mate and then we'll have a super race where they'll have my good looks and your intelligence. And he said, well, I understand what you're proposing, madam, but suppose our child ends up with your intelligence and my looks.
Yes. Well, of course. And it is a very funny story.
Bad idea. It's a bad idea. It does not work. It does not work. It's based on animal husbandry. And we have a fundamentally different operating system than animals. John B. Watson tried this, you know, tried out his version of this. It failed miserably. It's an obsolete idea. It doesn't work.
How could it not work, though? Because obviously, if you've got two intelligent parents, they're probably going to end up having an intelligent child.
And why is the child intelligent?
Genetics, high IQ.
Genetics. I'll give you. I have a different explanation. Okay, I've got grandchildren. I'm watching them grow up. I have 21 grandchildren. So I've been through this mill here with a lot of them. And I've had my own experience. I raised their parents of these grandchildren. And one of the things that I notice is that they talk a lot. You know, you talk to the child. You got to talk to the child when the child is young. You talk to the child as if the child understands you when you know damn well that the child does not or cannot understand you at a certain point. But then magically it does happen. Okay. These are habits that intelligent people have and pass on to their children.
I'm just imagining you talking to a baby about global oligarchic control and so on. It's quite an amusing image.
You're at the baby, and the baby understands what I'm saying. In some sense, it's a miracle, but the miracle happens all the time, and it's logos. It's not genetics. So if you talk to your child will become more intelligent. If you don't, if you park the kid in front of a television and do not talk to your child, he will become stupid. It's that simple, no matter what his genetic endowment is.
But surely things can be there, but they can be either nurtured or sabotaged by the way, you know, by nurture.
There. Yes, we all have brains. We all have minds, and they have to be nurtured. You have to act on them in a certain way. And there was always something miraculous, the possibility of something miraculous, like a guy who just has perfect pitch and, you know, can create melodies out of thin air that you can't and you wish you could. He has this musical ability. Where did that come from? There's something really mysterious about musical ability. And you could look into the Bach family and you could say, well, maybe it is genetic. I don't know. Maybe it is. But the fact is that if Johann Sebastian grew up on the south side of Chicago, he'd play rap music and no one would know that he was a genius because it's anti-music. So how do you separate? Let's go back to the Bach family. How are you going to separate that out? How are you going to separate C.P.E. Bach from Johann Sebastian Bach? You know, they had
or DJ Bach.
A rich musical culture. And obviously one of these guys was so far above normal that he became like one of the greatest composers in human history. But, you know, how does that factor in? I don't know. I don't know how you explain it genetically.
Well, surely it makes sense that both things are true, that, you know, both nature and nurture play a role here. And so genetics and upbringing, genetics and the culture that you grow up in, that would make sense. Because some, you know, you get all these different combinations where, like, two brothers, one they're very different, or two people who grew up in the same culture and they inherit the same ideas from that culture.
Studies are very interesting in that regard. I think that there, if you want my honest opinion, I think alcoholism is genetic. I think it is. They've done twin studies. It turns out that the twins both have a genetic predisposition toward alcoholism. You need a metabolism that acts in a certain way, and you inherit that that metabolism biologically from your parents. And that means certain cultures, certain groups probably tend toward it more than others, okay? But that doesn't change the fact that you have a will that can tell you, don't pick up the drink. And that's the end of alcoholism there. That's exactly the type of interface that I think solves the problem that we just, that we're talking about. Do you agree?
Oh, yeah. Of course, I agree that culture has a role to play and that individual decisions, your personal willpower and so on, also has a role to play. But I do think it's likely that abilities are largely genetically governed, or at least the limits of your abilities are genetically governed. And then it's a matter of how far you get to those limits, which in turn would be influenced by culture and so on.
Well, if they are governed, I don't know what the upper limit is. What's the upper limit? VO2 max? Do I do a VO2 max test and then decide whether I'm going to join the cross-country team? Is that the way it works?
I don't know.
Am I limited by my VO2 max? Am I limited?
I'm going to have to Google what VO2 max means.
It's the volume of oxygen that your lungs can metabolize.
Ah, right. Maximal oxygen uptake. Well, that probably would. I mean, of course, that would almost certainly help you to do certain things. That would make sense.
What are you saying? Okay, is my life determined by that? Let me put it even more specifically. Is my life as an athlete determined by that?
Well, I know that the best runners tend to be Ethiopian because they have some kind of genetically disposed.
That's not true. That's not true. I know. You go to Kenya, I know where they are. They're in Eldoret. And the reason they're really good runners in Eldoret is because they live above 9,000 feet, which means they have 75% of the oxygen that people have at sea level. And because they're 5 miles away from school, so they have to run to school or walk to school, you put those two things together, and that's the formula for Kenyan dominance in long-distance running. It turns out it's not just Kenyan dominance, it's Eldoret dominance because of the altitude.
It says here, Kalenjin have particularly thin ankles and calves.
Okay.
I mean, doesn't that imply genetics?
Sure it does. It's absolutely genetically determined. You're absolutely right.
Well, I'm not saying it's absolutely, but obviously training is important. Obviously culture is important.
Hey, so how are we going to put this? I'm trying to come up with a formula. That's why I gave you alcoholism. Ultimately, alcoholism depends on your willpower, not on your metabolism. And your willpower is logos.
Willpower, that's conscientiousness, which ability, self-discipline, which you could also say is, I wouldn't be at all surprised if that is also genetically influenced.
Explain that to me. How is willpower genetic? That's preposterous. I'm sorry. I'll go along with something. That's preposterous. Your willpower is something that you exercise. You use the reason that you have to, through the will, to choose the good, and you create habits. And if you have the right habits, you will have a successful life. And if you have bad habits, you'll have an unhappy life. But it all depends on your ability to determine your behavior.
Yeah, and willpower is definitely something that I think can be learned. I don't want to go into that too much because I do think it's something that's very cultural. But say something like mathematical ability. Do you not think that two mathematicians are likely to have a child who's good at maths?
Actually, math and music are completely mysterious because you seem to have this ability without any relationship to the real world. Okay, so I'm doing a book on aesthetics now, and I think it was Michelangelo, one of them said, there's no such thing as a young painter. There's no such. You have to practice painting. You have to spend a lot of time. Whereas you, in music, you can have a musical prodigy where you're playing like Mozart. What's he doing? He's composing symphonies when he's 6 years old or something like that. Where did that come from? That seems to me completely a priori, and I don't see any. Is it genetic? I don't know. I don't know what it is. I mean, obviously, we're talking about families. Wolfgang Amadeus, his father was a musician. He was raised in the most musically literate society in the history of the world, I would say, namely Vienna, at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century. So how, you know, all of this plays a role, but I'm going to concede. I'm trying to make your point here by saying this musical ability and mathematical ability seems to come from nowhere. It's not something you work on. You seem to have it as a child, and I can't explain why.
I would suggest genetics.
I don't know whether that explains it.
All right. I mean, obviously, there is a big debate here to be had. But so someone does ask, let's just sum it up. What percent is genetics and what percent is nurture? Now, I know that, well, that's obviously going to differ from one thing to another. Mr. Jones agrees. You go for it.
Well, I tried to explain this. I mean, you have a metabolism that makes you feel really good when you drink alcohol. That's genetic. I'm saying that's genetic. But you also have a mind that says, if I drink too much, I'm going to throw up on the lady's shoes next to me, and I'll feel bad tomorrow, and so therefore I'm not going to drink too much. So that's the combination that I'm trying to explain here.
Yes.
Let me put it this way. No matter what cards you are dealt with genetically, there's always a possibility of bringing them under control by logos and will. By reason and will.
Of course, willpower is a particularly dodgy one because I think it definitely is a choice. I mean, of course, it's a choice whether to drink or not, whether to smoke or not, and so on. So that's a bad example to choose. I think the better example is abilities. It shows mathematics, music, you could say language, you could even say humor, the ability to be witty. And of course, physical attributes.
That's completely ungenetic, as far as I can tell. I mean, that humor is something that is so culturally conditioned. You would have to learn it culturally through language. Humor is based on language.
Right. Okay. So I think we should get to the point about logos. What is logos? And what are you saying? When you say, because you're the phrase that often accompanies your name is logos is rising. So what is
logos is reason. Logos is speech. Logos is the order of the universe. And logos is God. St. John said that. I didn't say that. It's all of those things. It is your connection to reality. And it is the one thing that distinguishes us from animals and any other form of existence on the face of this earth. That we can sit here and flap our lips. I flap my lips here in Indiana, and your mind perceives all sorts of ideas halfway around the world. That's logos. We're talking to each other. We're communicating. That's the basis of human existence. That's what we do here. That's why we're human beings. That's what we do as human beings. And anything that contravenes logos is bad. And often sinful.
So what is why would you say that it's rising now? Why is that your thing?
Because we are first, it's a long story, okay, but that's why I wrote the book. But I mean, the fact is that we are making major breakthroughs in our understanding of the world now. We have broken through the social engineering that was imposed on us in the 1950s, 1960s, right after World War II. That was a major defeat for the American people. The fact that they internalized the commands of their oppressors and internalized these these commands of the social engineers and started acting according to them and believing certain things that were not in their interest. This is all falling by the wayside now. And to the point here is we're in this crucial moment now where half of the people in the United States of America believe the conventional narrative and half of the people do not believe it. That's a significant step forward. We've never had this type of, consciousness among a group of people who are in one way or another checking out of the thought control that's been imposed on them for generations now. That's why I say Logos is rising. Our conversation here is an example of that.
So even as the oligarchs expand their control, their grip on people throughout the course of this year, you see a counter to that happening at the same time.
Yes, the fact that you have to ban me means you can't answer my arguments. You lost. And so maybe at this point in time, you've got more political power than I do, and you can make it stick, but you can't shoot my ideas. My ideas are spreading. How many people believe, when I wrote Libido Dominandi and said sexual liberation and was a form of political control, people laughed at that idea. People are not laughing anymore. They're not laughing anymore. And proof that my ideas are getting across is the fact that they have to ban me. The ADL, the Jews have to go after me. They have to ban me because they cannot answer my arguments. Doesn't that strike you as a form of weakness?
Oh, yes. Oh, of course it is, because if they could answer us, they would, and they can't. So, and I just assume that whenever censorship is done, it's for that reason.
That's right. I remember a priest telling me that the church is still trying to catch up with Sigmund Freud. This was a disaster for the Catholic Church, that a man who was considered a priest, who dedicated his life to God, was too stupid to understand what Sigmund Freud was really saying. That was the consciousness that existed then. That consciousness is passing away. That man, although that generation is passing away, there's a new generation that is rising that has the consciousness that the predecessor did not have. That's why Logos is rising, because Logos is, in a sense, it's inevitable, because Logos is the force of human history. Logos is God working in human history. And what does God want? How does he move in human history? Through consciousness. Consciousness of the truth. Exposure of lies. This is all happening. And the fact, as I say, I keep saying it, but the fact they have to ban me is proof that Logos is rising.
Some of what you've said there actually reminds me of Terence McKenna. Are you familiar with that name?
No, I'm not.
Well, he is he died 20 years ago, but he was a psych. This might outrage you, and I'm curious about what you'll say about this. He was an ethnobotanist, which means that he was into psychedelic plants and, you know, fungi, mushrooms and drugs and so on. And he was very much an exponent of psilocybin, DMT, things like that. Do you have any time for psychedelics as a religious thing?
Absolutely no. Don't mess with your body's chemistry. And the fact that you can change chemicals in your brain and produce certain feelings or illusions is a dead end. It should be avoided at all costs. Do not get involved in this type of stuff. The most precious thing you have is your ability to reason. So don't fuck with your ability to reason, to put it plainly. I mean, I can change my mood very easily by having a drink. You know what I mean? That doesn't mean that reality has changed because I had a drink. My things were wet. The world, it was the old world yet. That's A.E. Housman. Terence, this is stupid stuff. Malt does more than Milton can to justify God's ways to man. The same thing is true of psilocybins, okay? And you end up with your clothes wet and wondering what happened to your necktie.
Right. Not your bow tie, presumably.
For I have left my... For I have left my necktie. I find it, I'm losing it. It's a great poem. I recommend.
All right. So I just wondered what you would say about the matter of psychedelics, because some people do see it as a sort of as a version of religion.
Yeah, bad religion. Sorry. That marijuana is the basis of Rastafarianism. Not a good religion. Bob Marley died of lung cancer. No, sorry. I can't endorse those religions.
All right. One final question. And if anyone has questions, please post them on Entropy for Mr. Jones. How would you define degeneracy? What is degeneracy?
Entartung, German word. You lose the form. The form gets lost.
Well, what is the form in this context?
It depends on what are we talking about?
Human behavior.
Okay,
let's
talk about art. Okay, I know it's going to be controversial, but the Germans, the Nazis had an exhibition called Entartete Kunst. Okay, degenerate art. What did they mean? Well, they were talking about modernity. They were talking about, I don't know, let's say cubism, maybe it wasn't abstract expressionism, that didn't exist anymore. They were talking about the fact that art had lost its form. It lost the ability to convey the form properly, human form, for example, nature, and so on and so forth. That's what degeneracy is. It's the loss of form.
And how does that manifest in human behavior?
The forms of behavior are social forms. There are social conventions that we have. There are certain customs. We tend to wear clothes when we're in public. This is a form, okay, a form of behavior. When people stop wearing clothes in public, they've lost the form, as they do in Germany. They go to the English Garden during the summer. They don't wear clothes there at that point. This is a form of degeneracy, loss of form, the forms of civilized behavior.
All right. All right. Well, surprisingly, there don't seem to be any questions for you on Entropy. I'm rather surprised.
Reduce the audience to silence.
Yeah, I think you have. So before we end, what would you say, what would you predict for America in 2021 on current trends?
Predict for what? America?
For America next year, going by what's happened this year.
The whole point is we are in a completely unprecedented situation. So the one thing that we can be certain of is that no matter who gets into the White House, half of the people are going to be upset and really upset. We can be certain about that, because we have these policies that have been followed here have led to complete disunity in the United States and a situation of at least cultural civil war. So there will be unhappy people. I can predict that with certainty.
All right. Well, let's leave it at that then, on that rather dark note. But this was your first appearance on Millennial. I do it every year, so it would be interesting to have you on again next year, if possible. Oh, someone says that they're posting a question now. Hold on a second. Ah, here we go. Your guest said that things that contradict Logos are bad. What are these things, and how can anything truly contradict Logos if Logos is God? Surely God is all-encompassing.
That's right. That's right. So how do we achieve the good? Action. Action. We have to act in order to achieve the good. Now, if you act in a way that violates the principles of your being, your rationality, that's you're acting against the moral law, that is bad. And that is bad for you, and it's bad for society. So God, the reason we can do this is because God gave us free will. So God is absolute logos. He created us with reason, he had to create free will to go along with it. Because you can't have one without the other. If you have reason, that's your guide in life. You have to have the freedom to make choices if you have reason. And so God knew that, and he knew that you could make bad choices, and there's no way he can prevent you from making bad choices. You can fuck up your life forever, forever, ever, ever, and be in pain for all eternity, because God will not violate your freedom. He will allow you that freedom to do that.
So it's a choice. Here's another question. Tom Sunek once said that he talked about the Grateful Dead with you. What are your thoughts on the Grateful Dead's music?
I don't ever remember talking to Tom Sunek about the Grateful Dead. Grateful Dead was Jerry Garcia was, if you watch Woodstock, the video, there's a picture of him rolling a joint. They would not put that video on his music because his music was so bad, it didn't make the cut. I have a priest friend who loves Jerry Garcia and says he was a genius when it came to improvisation. And I've listened to some of the stuff, and I think I can understand why. So I guess it just depends on which Jerry Garcia shows up. You know, being a heroin addict, I don't think helps your music. And that's what he was, and that's how he died. So that's pretty, but I really don't remember. I've had conversations with Tom. I really don't remember talking about the Grateful Dead with him.
All right. Okay, then. Well, I guess that is an end to it. So, E. Michael Jones, thank you very much for taking part in Millennial 2020.
My pleasure. Thank you for an interesting discussion.
All right. Glad you enjoyed it. I'll be back in 40 minutes on YouTube with Endeavor. That'll be the final stream for tonight. In the meantime, thank you to everyone for watching, and thank you to E. Michael Jones for taking part.
Thank you.
See you later.